Greetings and salutations, everyone. I am AC2GS. My name is Roy, and I'm net control operator for this, the Limark Technical Net, for over 44 years. All of you and myself, for some of that time, have been sitting in front of a desk and listening to our radio and talking to each other and teaching each other, learning from each other, and hopefully being entertained by each other. And I thank you once again for joining me this Sunday night at 8 p.m. when we try and do this all over again. So I will drop for a second, and I will give you the usual links. Okay, if you want to reach me via email, that would be for mailbag questions, for TechNet puzzles, and sundry other things. If you want to have me tap Paul on the shoulder and tell him about a NASA space-related story, of course, you can directly email him. He's available at spacenetreport@gmail.com. But my email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. We also offer a link page. I cut and paste interesting articles throughout the week, and I publish them for all to see. So if you got a case of insomnia one night, just type into your browser roy.ac2gs.com, and that'll bring up my link page, and you can read some interesting articles. We also have available a chat room. Sometimes it's busy, sometimes it's quiet. It depends. You get to it by typing into your browser chat.ac2gs.com. We also offer a internet audio stream of the Technical Net, and we keep it live the rest of the week so that you can listen into the Glen Oaks repeater even if you don't have a radio on you. The way to get into that is to type into your browser technet.ac2gs.com. And as always, I like to remind people that MyKC2NJI has a great archive site. It's called amateurradio.tv, and it has archives of the Limark Technical Net that go as far back as September of 2006. So avail yourself of the wisdom of people who've either moved out of the area or unfortunately become silent keys over the years. Let me drop, and I'll tell you what we got planned for tonight. It's a standard operating technical net tonight. I have a couple of very short comments to make about AI. I usually do that at the top of the technical net. And then we're going to go to questions, comments, and topics. Hopefully the first few will be amateur radio related, but we will accept any science and technology-based questions or topics. That should take us approximately to 10:15, and Paul will join us for the SpaceNet report. That should take us approximately to 11 p.m., and I will return to tie a bow on everything and wish you well for the coming week. So that's the plan. Hopefully, as long as the repeater doesn't hiccup and my shack doesn't hiccup and my All-Star link doesn't kick me off of the link too many times. Usually it's one or two times a night. So we'll see what happens. Anyway, so that's it. Let me drop and I'll give you my 2 cents worth for this week's number of AI news items. Okay, as much as we have listeners who really like ChatGPT, all flavors of it, I still get a sense on the Internet that people are not quite thrilled beyond belief with the new iteration of 5. I think they felt that when it went from 2 to 3, it was somewhat revolutionary. When it went from 3 to 4, it was, again, somewhat revolutionary. And whereas ChatGPT 5 is more of an incremental tweaking and tuning. So the big question is, why aren't the advances coming as fast and furious? And it falls back to, you know, some people believing that there is an intrinsic wall when it comes to generative AI, which is the method being used for present artificial intelligences. Time will tell. Money is flooding the market. These AI companies are going through billions of dollars a month. I think Grok loses about $1 billion a month And ChatGPT is always looking for more investors. So a lot of money in, not much money coming out of it. And, of course, as I mentioned a few weeks ago, the MIT study suggested that most businesses that have invested in actual AI technology have not really been able to monetize it for themselves. A lot of these companies are kind of selling it at as a loss. To get people to accept it and get used to it and develop a need for it. Some people's brains don't work as well as they used to because they rely on ChatGPT doing their work for them, I hear. Anyway, that's it. Also, unfortunately, there's still more cases of ChatGPT producing some AI psychosis in individuals. There was an unfortunate gentleman in, I think, Connecticut, in his mid-50s, who was really revved up by ChatGPT and unfortunately is said to have ended in a murder-suicide. So it's rather sad that these people are treating ChatGPT as their analyst. And they're not, it's not designed to be an analyst, so it's misusing the technology, but nevertheless, it's leading too many people astray. So we'll see how things develop next week for the world of AI. There's the perpetual AI bubble. Even Sam Altman admits that there's an AI bubble. The only question is, when is it going to burst and how badly is it going to burst? So we'll keep you aware of what's going on. Let me drop for a second and we'll move on to our... Well, let me ask if anyone has any comments before I move on to the next segment.
W2BZ.
Yes, Rich.
Did you say that Grok is losing $1 billion with a B, $1 billion a month?
That's what the newspapers indicate. Yeah, it costs a lot of money to do this. A lot of electricity, a lot of servers, a lot of work. And they're trying to build it up. I'm sure that Elon has not stopped with this iteration. So he's building up a bigger and bigger server farm.
Wow, that's a lot of money. I never heard of a company losing $1 billion a month. That's a lot of loss. How are these companies going to make money?
That's the $1 billion question. They believe that it's going to usher in a whole new world of infinite resources. I don't know how that works. And I think they don't know how that works. But that's the problem. None of these guys seem to have a business plan where they explain where the trillions of dollars of profit are coming from. Your guess is as good as mine.
But there are some smart guys doing this and some smart guys investing in this. And if they didn't see any potential of profit down the line, I don't know how all these smart guys are just, putting in these billions of dollars and not even having a way to make any money on it.
Yeah, well, I mean, we all seem to have different opinions of wealthy people. I tend to believe that wealthy people either just kind of lucked into it from their ancestors, or they were very lucky, or they're a little bit of a con man. So they're not necessarily the smartest guys. If you ever listen to these billionaires, the one thing I'm incredibly impressed upon is the inherent stupid things that they tend to say on the air. Now, it might be mic fright, or they might be having a bad day, or they might be taking a wee bit too much microdose of ketamine. But it's not necessarily true that very wealthy people are inherently brilliant. They might be very good at one aspect of life, but if you kind of spread it out and look around, there's a lot of things that they believe in, that they spend money on, that's kind of dumb as rocks. I recently watched the YouTube where Larry Ellison of Oracle, who might be the second wealthiest guy who keeps his mouth shut, wasted billions of dollars trying to grow produce in Hawaii. not bothering to ask any farmers of how it works. He simply kind of decided that he was so clever he could figure it out himself and failed miserably. I think at this point they sell a pineapple for something like $25 a pound, which I don't know who buys it at that price. Anyway, the bottom line is I tend to think even wealthy people can be fooled. I give you that biology company that was worth the tens of billions of dollars, Elizabeth Holmes' company, that was a complete fraud. A lot of very wealthy and a lot of smart people invested in her company.
Well, I could sort of see how they could make money from corporations and research facilities and universities, because, as you know, I'm using AI, and I'm using all of them to find a job for my daughter, and I'm getting better and better at it. But Grok, after I ask Grok about, or I tell Grok to find a certain configuration of prompt that I'm asking it to find for a job, after about four of them, it says that, you're out of the freebies now. If you want to continue on, you have to, click on this, and it becomes, a payable thing. I don't know how much they want, but it's, you can't do a lot with them. When you really get into it, you can't do a lot with them for free. And I don't know if they're making any money on the paid versions of them, but I could see corporations, easily paying for Grok or for ChatGPT or for DeepSeek or any of them. I could see corporations paying for it. So there's got to be some kind of revenue stream down the line rather than nothing. The way you put it, it sounds like there's no revenue stream. Go ahead.
Well, right now, they're operating at losses. All of these big AI companies are asking for investors to give them billions of dollars to keep the ball rolling. So maybe sometime down the road, and this has been a perpetual problem with the dot-com burst. The problem is some sites can be very popular but be impossible to monetize. I don't know if you're familiar with Reddit. Reddit was one of those companies that basically lost money, but they were very popular and they were building up bigger and bigger user groups, and then they finally decided that they had built up big enough and they wanted to make money off of it. And every opportunity that they've tried to do it has not been terribly successful. So there remains companies with enough investors willing to bankroll it with some optimism in the future that it will turn a profit. Keep in mind that this is the nature of the Internet. Amazon made no money probably at least for the first 10 years. It was a going thing that it was just operating at a loss, and people were just throwing more and more money into it, and finally it turned around. And now it's worth loads and loads of money, and everyone wants to be the next Amazon. So as much as it's hard to believe, I know of no AI company, in the United States at least, that's turning a profit. Some of them have paid programs so that they're losing less money. But none of them are making any money to speak of. It seems strange, but again, this is how Amazon began, and some investors think that it's going to happen like that again.
Well, just the little application, the one little application, like looking for a job that I'm using these AI engines for, it's so sophisticated in how they're searching the different job websites for different criteria that I couldn't imagine looking for a job without them. I don't know how anybody does that on the Internet to look for a job without using AI, because each one of them uses a different method for searching the job boards with your criteria that you give them, and some of them are a little suspect because they return the answers too quickly. Grok takes its time and tells you exactly the logic that it's using and where it's searching and all that. It's pretty wondrous to me anyway. But, I just can't imagine that at this point anyway, because it's not a new concept now. It's what, 2-3 years old now in terms of publicity, that AI is still scratching their head in terms of they have no way to make any money in the future. I think it would have collapsed already. Maybe, I don't know. Back to you, Roy.
No, that's not how economics work. It's not quite that it's not making anybody. Obviously, there are people who are paying into different services. The problem is that building things up costs a lot more money they can possibly extract at this time. And so they're losing a little bit less than if they gave it away entirely. And there, you know, for a short period of time, you could use it for free, which is you've experienced. And there are other options out there that are either low cost or free for a limited amount of time. But it requires a lot of expensive silicon from NVIDIA, who's now worth, I've lost track, I think $2-3 trillion value. That's when the bubble bursts, that's going to go down too, unfortunately. But, you know, it's very expensive to build these server farms, and it requires electricity, which is a scarcity, and we're going to have problems with our electric bill in the next few years as artificial intelligence soaks up more and more power, the price of electricity to us is going to go up, so we're going to feel that. And just building the facilities and all the outlier effects. Grok has built a massive center right away from, I think, Memphis, and they're using unregulated gas electric power to run it, and they're basically polluting Tennessee. So, you know, it's going to be an economic problem. But right now, they're not making money. But again, there's a lot of companies that happen to. Reddit still isn't making money, as far as I'm aware. And like I said, the big version of that is Amazon. For 10 years, you couldn't get a dime from your Amazon stock until finally they reached a critical mass and they figured it all out. And you know, Amazon not only sells products, but they sell advertising as well. So there's a lot of ways that they make money. So, but they had to figure that out. And whether or not all of these AIs will figure it out is up in the air. My guess, at the very least, is there's far too many AI companies. I don't think the world needs that many. So even if a few of them become profitable, I think it's at the expense of the rest of them going bankrupt or being bought up. But, you know, I'm not an economist, so I don't know. That's just my guess.
There are only about 5 of them that the public can access. There's ChatGPT, there's DeepSeek, there's Gemini, and one other that I use. Claude. So I think it's called Claude. But those are the only 5 out there, so there aren't a hell of a lot of them. But we'll see. I mean, there's always a correction in bubbles like this. But the Internet surely came back strong from the bubble that burst, and with tremendous value, too. So we'll see, Roy. Okay, back to you, W2BZ.
Okay, very good. Yeah, I mean, there's only one Amazon. So, you know, whether there's room in the world for 5, and you know, if you give him enough time and enough seed money, a lot of the people working for those 5 companies will quit and open their own company, and, you know, you never know. But I don't know if there's really place in the world for more than 2. at least two national ones, two in the United States. But again, we will all see, hold our breath, and hope it doesn't disrupt the economy way too much. Thanks, Rich. Anyone else with any comments before we move on?
KG2VHD.
Yes, Jim.
All right. I can't help but keep thinking that with this AI stuff, if you store everything, one of the things that gets stored is every mistake you have ever made in your whole life. Obviously, we're at the tail end of that, and there's a lot of people at the beginning end of it. But if every mistake you've ever made is stored, you're doomed. Stalin would have loved such a system like that. He spoke about that type of concept where show me the man and I'll show you the crime. This whole thing is nuts. I think it's a bad idea from go. But that's the philosophy net, sorry. Back to that.
Comments?
Yeah, please.
Good evening. This is AC2KY. Good evening, Roy. Good evening, Ned. Very interesting conversation. You know, I was using ChatGPT earlier today just to check some accuracy, and I threw in something simple like, what's the correct secondary fusing side of a 75 kVA transformer 12208? And ChatGPT, it didn't pick up on, it gave me the wrong answer, is the bottom line. You have to be very specific. You have to say things like three-phase, you know, whatever topic you're doing. I've caught a lot of errors, but I just wanted to make that comment. The second one was a question, and I'll let it go. What's the difference between the $10, the $20, and the $200 fee on these AIs?
Well, it sort of depends upon the company because they all have their own weird little idea. I know one of the big differences between the two lower tiers and the $200 tier is that you could actually go back on it from ChatGPT 5 to 4. The benefit of 4 is 4 was the latest, greatest engine. 5, unfortunately, OpenAI decided to kind of reconfigure ChatGPT to have all the modules from the smartest deep thinking module to the dumbest as a rock module. And it switches between them based on some pseudo-random algorithm, I believe. But that's another way of them saving money. Not only, they are offering you 5, but sometimes 5 is as dumb as 3. So if you pay for the $200, you can lock yourself into ChatGPT 4.0 and get a reasonably clever algorithm that never defaults to slower, dumber versions. So that's and also probably more hours and more. I don't know if they charge by the hour or they charge by there's a phrase that's used in artificial intelligence that has to do with tokens. They call them tokens. So usually you get to use more tokens. And artificial intelligence uses up tokens on you asking questions and it offering answers. So it totes up the token count, and when you reach your highest token count, it locks you down until the token count recycles. So that's one of the things that I know of as far as the $200 gets you some extra aspects. And getting back to what you mentioned earlier, I think the problem is AI inherently is very bad at interpreting people. You have to, as you mentioned, you have to be extremely precise in the way that you word things. Otherwise, it will assume stuff that it has no particular reason to assume. I used to ask these things what the width of an electromagnetic wave was. And unfortunately, a lot of them decided to assume that I meant what's the bandwidth of an electromagnetic wave, which is not the same question. So I had to be very precise before they would even attempt to give me a credible answer.
QSL. I got all of that. Well, thank you very much for your comment. I actually picked up a lot on BZ's question and your answers. So back to net.
Okay, very good. Jim, did you have something else you wanted to say?
Oh, sure. I think that fake intelligence, because it's not artificial intelligence, it's fake intelligence, has no ability to reason. It's just kind of taking a great big giant survey. And I don't think we should rely on it for anything. Most importantly, deciding my offspring's career should be decided by offspring, not me. This is bad ground we're on here. It's like walking into a mud field that you can sink in. I'm very leery about the whole thing. Sorry to be so non-specific, but there you go. Back to that.
Okay, Jim, this is AC2GS, by the way. Just wondering, are you familiar with the term Palantir?
I know it's a big company that is engaged in all sorts of stuff like this, and it's troubling.
Yeah, I mean, if you're concerned about artificial intelligence, Peter Thiel has this, who's a big billionaire investor in all of this tech. You know, he kind of made a name for himself back in the days of, I think it was PayPal. Anyway, he has this company, and there's something strange about him. I mean, if you have nothing better to do, you know, search him on YouTube. He did an interview where he basically kind of indicated he wasn't concerned with the future of humanity, which kind of scares everyone, and he looks a little scary. You know, he looks a little neurodivergent. But, and he also, he names a lot of his little toys after evil things from Lord of the Rings. Palantir was a seeing stone that some of the most evil characters in Lord of the Rings had access to. So it always concerns me that he named it Palantir. But it is a massive database that is collecting everything on every individual. Eventually, I think Peter Thiel's idea is that the government can just go to Palantir and get a readout of every last one of us. So it's far more scary than just artificial intelligence, which is fundamentally a word completion algorithm. You give it the first few words of a paragraph, and it'll try to complete it according to all the samples that it was taught, you know, billions and billions of texts. That it assimilated and figured out what the probability of one word following the other. But this is pure, 1984 stuff. So anyone who hasn't heard of Palantir, you know, look it up and don't go down the rabbit hole from Lord of the Rings. Just if you see Peter Thiel's name mentioned, that's the Palantir I was telling you about.
It's definitely a thing. Definitely a thing. I'll remind everybody, if it's free, you're not the customer. You're the product being sold.
Yeah, the first time I heard that line, they were discussing Facebook.
There you go. Back to that. Good stuff tonight.
Thank you. Anyone else with any comments before we move on to the next segment?
Kilo Charlie 2, Delta Alpha Whiskey, supporting.
Thank you. Anyone else with any comments before we move on to the next segment?
Alpha Echo 2, Yankee Golf, checking in.
Okay, Sam, good to hear you.
Listening and enjoying.
Okay, that's the point, and no cover charge. Keep that in mind. Anyway, I think we're talked out, although we'll probably get back to this subject again and again and again. It's going to be in the news. It's going to make a lot of news. It's going to make some people very wealthy and some people very poor. many things these days. Anyway, let's move on to our next segment, questions, comments, and topics for discussion. Once again, I would prefer if the first few be amateur radio related, but we will entertain any science and technology questions, comments, or topics. So hit that push to talk, give us your first name, whether it's amateur radio or not, and we'll write them all down.
Yeah, BZ, amateur radio.
Anyone else want to be on the list tonight?
K2BHD, amateur radio.
Okay, Rich and Jim recognize. Anyone else have any questions or comments for tonight? Let me know. Okay, hopefully as the night progresses, there'll be more people and more questions and more topics and more lively discussions. Rich, what do you got for us tonight?
Okay, it's about chokes. I guess specifically RF chokes, common mode chokes. The first question is, are RF chokes and common mode chokes the same thing?
Yes.
Okay. Well, you can take a piece of coax and wind it with about six windings around a toroid. And there's your choke. But you also can wind it six ways around one side of the toroid, then push the coax through the opening in the toroid and wind it the other way around on the other side with six more turns. My question is, what's the difference between the two types of chokes?
I have an answer.
Okay, Jim, feel free.
I've been trying to figure that out for a while myself, and if I'm wrong, those with decades more experience in this, feel free to shoot me down. But I think it's mostly mechanical. It's like, where do you want the pieces and parts to come out of the coil and work with the device you're actually constructing? That crossover thing gives you, you know, the ability to have the wire exit at a convenient point. Or not, depending on what you're actually trying to accomplish. So it's a mechanical thing more than an electrical thing. And if I'm wrong, please correct. Back to Roy.
Okay, Jim. See, if it was the same number of coils, I would agree with you. But in Rich's example, I believe the second example has twice as many coils. And approximately every time you put another coil in that toroidal ferrite, you basically increase the reactance and the inductance that goes up by exponentially. So the more times that you coil a piece of coax around the toroid, the higher and higher the inductance is and the higher and higher the reactance is, and it impedes common mode current because it's acting simply as an inductor. So even if you kind of just split the coax and introduced your own inductance to the electronics, you'd get sort of the same thing. The more times you have coils, the more powerful the core, air core, is far less powerful than ferrite cores and such. It increases the impedance of that particular choke.
But I think the crossing over
is overkill.
It has more to do with
how much do you need to choke. I mean, what would be the operational difference between six windings around a toroid or 12 windings, six of which go in the opposite direction of the first six? What would be the resultant benefits of doing it one way or another? Because I see them done both ways, and I can't figure out why. But then why do people use just 6-8 turns around a choroid and that's it for an RF choke?
Okay, unfortunately, for most of that, Rich, you doubled with Jim, and I think there was even a third person. So there was, for a short period of time, I think there was a third guy who was basically trying to tell both of you that you were doubling, except that when you're doubling, you're transmitting. You don't listen. So it's pointless to tell someone that they're doubling with someone while they're doubling with someone. It just leads to tripling. The point is that the more impedance you have, the more you're attenuating the common mode. It's not a binary plus zero or one situation. You put a choke on your transmission line, your common mode currents are attenuated. They might be attenuated enough not to cause any problems in your shack, but they might not be. Again, it's a, you know, is it 3 dB of attenuation? Is it 6 dB? Is it 12 dB? You could never have too much attenuation, but you don't really want common mode at all in your shack. But that requires putting more strain on the coaxial cable, of looping it more times, and some people don't feel it's necessary. It's kind of overkill, if you will. So although in a perfect universe, it's really nice to have an infinite impedance of your common mode, functionally, all you have to do is attenuate it, 7 or 8 dB. And, you know, if you want to put another two loops, you're free to do that. And trying to answer Jim as well. Again, it's a more, whether or not you loop it back on itself is more of a mechanical that you mentioned. But for the most part, it's still the fact that the number of coils that you put on the toroid are going to affect the amount of attenuation, whether you back them up or you just do them in the same clockwise rotation.
How do you know what's enough? That's the question. How do you know what's enough?
Usually it's practical experience. If you make a choke and you're still getting stuff in your shack, then you modify your choke with a few more loops. John, you wanted to say something?
Yes, this is WA2VDH. One of the gentlemen mentioned winding in the opposite direction. Doing that will cancel out any inductive effects. If you take a ferrite rod and you wind 10 turns clockwise and 10 turns counterclockwise, you do not have an inductor. Go ahead.
So how do all these balances that do that work?
Most of the ones I've seen, you're winding in one a direction. I don't think I've seen where they wind some in a couple of turns clockwise and then reverse a couple of turns counterclockwise. I've seen on my own vertical, my R4 vertical, my R7 vertical that I have, I've taken the extra cable and wound it into a clockwise loop and taped that together to act as a common mode choke. But if I took that and wound 10 turns clockwise and then reversed 10 turns counterclockwise, I don't think I would have a choke. Go ahead.
Okay. I mean, the configuration that I'm thinking of and that I think that Jim was thinking of is where they make a bunch of loops for half of the toroid. Then instead of continuing on, they go across the toroid and start to wind on the other side of the toroid back to the point where they make the long bit of wire across the diameter. I'm not quite sure whether it's clockwise or counterclockwise, but I've seen loads of toroids configured that way.
But the sense of the current flow around, you know, if you do the right-hand rule thing, the sense of current flow around the magnetic material should be the same, even if they go across. I can't see them doubling back and then winding in the opposite sense of the direction that they have originally wound.
Yeah, it might be in the same direction, but it's done to cross over so that you get your wires at one end of the ballon in a different configuration. You have one wire on the far side and the other wire on the near side of the coiled toroid.
Yeah, they don't want to have an excessive mechanical strain, which might tend to fracture the ferrite material. But I think the sense of the winding around the magnetic material should be the same.
Perhaps. It's just that, like I said before, it's more of a mechanical aspect. But because you're effectively doubling the number of coils at the toroid, you're increasing the inductance and the reactance and the ultimate impedance of the common mode currents.
Yeah, the inductance is going to go up as n squared, if I remember correctly. Yeah.
Hey, it's Bill.
Yes.
Yeah, hi, Roy. I think the difference between those two designs that the other gentleman's talking about is the one that you're talking about goes through the middle. It actually passes through the center of the core, and that counts as one of the turns, and then continues in the same direction, as he was saying. If it just went over the top of the ferrite, then it would reverse the direction of the turns.
Yeah, so it's just a mechanical aspect of completing all the turns that fit on your toroid and have the leads at opposite ends of your toroid, just for the mechanical sake of putting together a balance configuration where you have the input on one end and the output on the other end instead of having the two wires kind of meet at the same point.
Yeah, Roger. And that pass through the middle counts as one turn, if I recall correctly.
Yeah. Anyway, does that make sense, Rich?
Yes and no, because I've seen a tremendous amount of RF chokes where they go through the core and come back out the other side and then wrap it around the other direction. So I'm just wondering, all the times that I've seen it done that way, are they just canceling each other out?
No, it's not the direction. It's the clockwise or counterclockwise nature of the winding. The winding itself is still in the same direction, but the winding across the toroid is in the opposite direction because you went through the center and the diameter, and then you started to wind again. But they're all being wound in the same clockwise or counterclockwise configuration. It's not the path that the coils take. It's the whether the coils themselves are clockwise or counterclockwise in orientation.
Okay, I thought they'd done counterclockwise, so I may be wrong.
Yes, John.
If you draw a donut and then put some loops around it and showing it going backwards and then apply the right-hand rule to it, put a direct current through it and follow the arrows along the windings around this donut shape and then apply the right-hand rule and you should let your fingers point in the direction of current flow and your thumb in both cases should aid the direction of the magnetic field. Do that old right-hand rule thing and I think you can sort of see how it works.
You don't necessarily have to kind of understand the nitty gritty of it as long as you understand that, clockwise is one thing and the direction that you're along the toroid that you're winding is not inherently clockwise or counterclockwise. It depends on other factors. Okay, I guess that's that. Anything else, Rich?
No, that's about it. I will investigate this further. Because unless I'm crazy, I've seen a lot of times where they're winding them in the opposite direction. So, but I'll investigate this more now. That's it, Roy. WTBZ, back to net.
Okay, very good. Unfortunately, other than one-to-one balance, the more esoteric balance, you know, if you follow the path of some of those wires, you can get cross-eyed. It's almost a black art. You know, I have that book that everyone mentions about balance design, and, you know, I try to follow it with the pictures and such, and, you know, especially some of the more complicated ones can get very confusing.
What's the difference between a one-to-one balance and an RF choke?
Pretty much nothing. Just a way of explaining it. You could use a balun, even a transformer balun, with the same number of turns on the primary and secondary, and it will be one-to-one. Or you could use a regular RF choke where you're just using the toroid as a ferrite core for a standard inductor with just the primary and nothing else. You know, it's different ways of expressing the same thing.
WB2IKT.
Yes.
Oh, thank you, Roy. A couple of questions. I'm in the process of building a new antenna for myself, and I got a balun. And one of my goals using a balun was to use the balun sort of like literally like a transformer, and have that transformer set up so it has a primary, which is connected to the coax, and then having a secondary, you know, so it's a one-to-one balun, but I wanted the secondary of the element side, not the coax side, to be center tapped, and then take that center tap and actually ground it, and try and make sure that the elements are at a DC ground. The folks over at Palomar tried to argue with me and get me out of that. They know a lot more about balance than me, so there's got to be a reason for that argument. But I've noticed that antennas that are at DC ground seem to be quieter and pick up less noise than antennas that are not at DC ground. Any comments on that, and can I use a balun to help that? Then I have one more question.
Okay, I would tend to take the advice of the guys at Palomar because their business is balanced. There must be some gotcha in the design that would cause a failure mode. We got any chipper electrical engineers out there who have any opinions on the subject? I'd love to hear it. I guess not, unfortunately, but I wish I could tell you the reason for that, but I would sort of, you know, all things considered, listen to the words of the guys at Palomar. If you're making a living selling a product, I assume you have a lot better understanding and practical experience with it than the average guy.
Yeah, I
think
you
assume
too much. I'm trying to figure out why he would have said that. But also, it's a question. A few years ago, you wrote an article about a fan dipole antenna that apparently is at your QTH. And I'm not quite as space restricted as you are, but I'm looking for an antenna that has a linear length that's relatively short. And I'd like to do 80 meters with it. And the one that you wrote about sounded pretty good. And you had lots of pictures about how you put it up and so on. But what you didn't write were any...
You just dropped out of the repeater. That's interesting. He just dropped out of the repeater. Are you out there? Well, hopefully he'll return soon. Jim, I realized that you were going to say something along those lines. But, you know, I mean, give people the benefit of the doubt, eh?
Okay.
Question.
Yeah?
Alpha Echo 2, Yankee Golf. I have a question for you, Roy.
Okay, Sam?
I have a grounding rod. Goes into the ground, I guess, 3 to 4 feet or whatever, and I have a wire coming from the ground up to the third floor where my transceivers are, and I attach the ground to those transceivers, and I was advised that if I'm above 20 feet or something like that, the ground has no effect, and it's like I have no ground, even though I grounded it. Are you familiar with what I'm talking about, and do you have any comment?
Yeah, well, you know, there are different ways of connecting your shack ground to your ground rod. I would tend to minimize the amount of inductance that wire would have. That's the problem with a very long length of wire. As it gets longer and longer, it's seen generally as another inductor that has reactance, that has impedance, and that has that blocks the ground current. So at best, you want to diminish the inherent inductance of the wire connecting your shack to the ground rod. And you should use a flat a strip of wire rather than a cylindrical piece of wire. And even with a strap wire, you're going to have a certain amount of impedance. But, you know, my attitude is better a little than nothing at all. It might not be as effective as if you were on the first floor, but since your choices are absolutely nothing, you know, infinite impedance of not being connected to the ground, or, you know, maybe 50 ohm impedance or what have you, you're better off with that. It's not the perfect thing, especially stations that are located excessively high in skyscrapers basically run without proper grounding because there's just no way to accomplish it in their circumstances.
Thank you, Roy. So I guess there's some truth to what I was told. Thank you very much.
Yep. The gentleman who mentioned my Alpha Delta fan dipole, are you back yet?
Yeah, my battery died on my HT. I just changed it.
Okay, so you're going to say the thing that I didn't mention about my Alpha Delta was?
Good to know when it died. Yes, it's WB2IKT. And with performance data. How well is it working, and did you take any measurements, SWR runs or anything else?
Yeah, I plotted them a lot. I was a little obsessive compulsive back then, and I had my first vector network analyzer. The performance on 80 was not really great. It was a very, very high Q situation, so there's very little area that I could tune to without playing around with my antenna tuner. 40 and 20 and 10 were pretty good. Of course, you had to kind of tune it up because out of the box, it was kind of all over the place as far as resonance was concerned. But, yeah, I did a whole bunch of VNA sweeps with that fan dipole.
Well, thank you, because I just finished winding the coils, and I have the wire, and now I have to buy some masks. So that's a help. I'm glad it's working. I'm going to see if it'll work for me, too.
Great. I loved it. It fell apart from the wind. So alternative, I believe it was a Spanish manufacturer, and unfortunately, I found that it used slightly thinner gauge wire and it snapped on me. So I would continue going with the Alpha Delta. Sometimes it's not in stock, unfortunately, but I found it a very nice all-round antenna, especially with my Flex Radio, the 6700, that you could set up a whole bunch of different pan adapters simultaneously. The beauty of a pan dipole is that it selects the leg that it travels on based upon, you know, impedance. The wire that's cut for 10 meter will kind of give you 10 meter signals going down your transmission line into the Flex 6700, and the 40 will go down the 40 line. So it's very nice how nature kind of takes care of things that otherwise would be a bit of a nuisance.
Right. A little counts there. Very good. Okay. My antenna would have 14-gauge wire, and again, homemade coils. So this is kind of like a do-it-yourself version. So we'll see how much I can work with it. I do have a question on the when it's spreading on 10 meters and on the 20-meter element. What is the distance on those spacers? It looks like it's about a foot or so. Is that about right?
Well, I mean, the wider you can make it, the better, because it's going to have interactions. One of the nuisances of fan dipoles is if you adjust the resonance for one of the elements, you're pretty much stuck readjusting the other. The store-bought variety only has maybe about an inch and a half, 2 inches at most between the elements. But the wider you space them, the better for not having so much coupling problems.
Wow, that 1 inch is much tighter than I thought it was. Okay, so I'm planning on using about a foot between them, and maybe even 2 feet, at least on the 20 to 40 meter segment.
Okay, I mean, they could never be too far. Far is better. It's not as easy mechanically, obviously, but for the nature of the tendency for nearby elements in the near field to couple and detune each other, it's less of a nuisance. So I wish you good luck, and I hope you come back and tell us how it worked out for you.
AF2P with a comment.
I intend to do that,
sure,
Roy, and you'll probably also be able to read it in the Limark log, so that will be the destination of whatever I do with this thing.
Okay, very good. Someone wanted to say something?
Yes, Ed, AF2P. I am very pleased with the inverted V configuration of a double bazooka. This cuts for both 40 and 80. I don't have the room to stretch something out at 120 feet. But it works very well for me, so if the fan dipole lets you down, which I don't think it will, but if it lets you down, you might consider that. That's all. AFCC clear.
Yeah, double bazookas have a very low Q of wonderful bandwidth. If you can find a place to put them, even in inverted V, they have probably one of the better bandwidths that you could get.
That you know, I could back that up with my performance. I agree with you all, Roy. It looks pretty good for me, but you know, I always kind of sneered at the idea of an inverted V. I don't know where I got that prejudice from, but the damn thing works, so what can I say? I enjoy it.
Well, that's the bottom line. It works. I know Bob Heil, who recently passed away. In his retirement, he moved to some farmland with a lot of empty space, and he put up a whole bunch of monoband double Zeppelins. I think he didn't have to put them in the V inverted V configuration, and he swore by them.
On the first day they opened, 17, I built an extended double Zeppelin, and that thing worked gangbusters.
Yeah, you just have to have a little bit extra space, even if you're doing inverted V. I doubt that I could put something like that up on my 50 by 20 foot city line.
You'd have a hell of a job getting an apex angle. You want about 90 degrees or more. Actually, 120 is best. You have a hell of a job with that.
Yeah. Oh, well. But, again, good luck. And to everyone, antennas is probably the most interesting subject we handle here because there are so many different options. You know, when it comes to hardware, most of us can't